Chapter 25. Fachini, and now in St. Mark's, plus the music of innumerable shovels, smote upon my ear, and I saw the shivering legion of poverty as it engaged the elements in a struggle for the possession of the piazza. But the snow continued to fall, and through the twilight of the descending flakes all this toil and encountered looked like that weary kind of effort in dreams, when the most determined industry seems only to renew the task. The lofty crest of the bell tower was hidden in the folds of falling snow, and I could no longer see the golden angel upon its summit. But looked at across the piazza, the beautiful outline of St. Mark's Church was perfectly penciled in the air, and the shifting threads of the snowfall were woven into a spell of novel enchantment around the structure that always seemed to me too exquisite in its fantastic loveliness to be anything but the creation of magic. The tender snow had compassionated the beautiful edifice for all the wrongs of time, and so hid the stains and ugliness of decay, that it looked as if just from the hand of the builder, or, better said, just from the brain of the architect. There was marvelous freshness in the colors of the mosaics, in the great arches of the facade, and all that gracious harmony into which the temple rises, or marble scrolls and leafy exuberance airily supporting the statues of the saints, was 100 times etherealized by the purity and whiteness of the drifting flakes. The snow lay lightly on the golden gloves, that tremble like peacock's crests above the vast domes, and plumed them with softest white. It robed the saints in ermine, and it danced over all its works, as if exulting in its beauty, beauty which filled me with subtle, selfish yearning to keep such evanescent loveliness for the little while longer of my whole life, and with despair to think that even the poor lifeless shadow of it could never be fairly reflected in picture or poem. Through the wavering snowfall, the Saint Theodore upon one of the granite pillars of the Piazzetta did not show so grim as his wont is, and the winged lion on the other might have been a winged lamb, so gentle and mild he looked by the tender light of the storm. The towers of the island churches loomed faint, and far away in the dimness, the sailors in the rigging of the ships that lay in the basin wrought like phantoms among the shrouds. The gondola stole in, and out of the opaque distance more noiselessly and dreamily than ever, and a silence, almost palpable, lay upon the mutest city in the world. The spirit of Venice is there, of a city where age and decay, fagged with distributing damage and repulsiveness among the other cities of the planet in accordance with the policy and business of their profession, come for rest and play between seasons, and treat themselves to the luxury and relaxation of sinking the shop, and inventing and squandering charms all about, instead of abolishing such as they find, as it their habit, when not on vacation. In the working season they do business in Boston sometimes, and a character in the undiscovered country takes accurate note of pathetic effects wrought by them upon the aspects of a street of once dignified and elegant homes whose occupants have moved away, and left them a prey to neglect, and gradual ruin and progressive degradation. A descent which reaches bottom at last, when the street becomes a roost for humble professionals of the faith cure and fortune-telling sort. What a queer, melancholy house, what a queer, melancholy street. I don't think I was ever in a street before when quite so many professional ladies, with English surnames, preferred Madam to Mrs. on their door plates. And the poor old place has such a desperately conscious air of going to the deuce. Every house seems to wince as you go by, and button itself up to the chin for fear you should find out it had no shirt on, so to speak. I don't know what's the reason, but these material tokens of a social decay afflict me terribly. A tipsy woman isn't dreadfuler than a haggard old house that's once been a home in a street like this. Mr. Howell's pictures are not mere stiff, hard, accurate photographs. They are photographs with feeling in them, and sentiment, photographs taken in a dream, one might say. As concerns his humor, I will not try to say anything, yet I would try, if I had the words, that might approximately reach up to its high place. I do not think anyone else can play with humorous fancy so gracefully and delicately and deliciously as he does, nor has so many to play with, nor can come so near making them look as if they were doing the playing themselves, and he was not aware that they were at it. For they are unobtrusive, unquiet in their ways, and well conducted. His is a humor which flows softly all around about and over and through the mesh of the page, pervasive, refreshing, health-giving, and makes no more show, and no more noise, than does the circulation of the blood. There is another thing which is contentingly noticeable in Mr. Howells' books. That is his stage directions, those artifices which authors employ to throw a kind of human naturalness around a scene and a conversation, and help the reader to see the one, and get at meanings in the other which might not be perceived, if entrusted unexplained to the bare words of the talk. Some authors overdo the stage directions, they elaborate them quite beyond necessity. They spend so much time and take up so much room in telling us how a person said a thing, and how he looked and acted when he said it, that we get tired and vexed, and wish he hadn't said it all. Other authors' directions are brief enough, but it is seldom that the brevity contains either wit or information. Writers of this school go in racks in the matter of state directions, the majority of them having nothing in stock but a cigar, a laugh, a blush, and a bursting into tears. In their poverty they work these sorry things to the bone. They say, ... replied Alfred, flipping the ash from his cigar. This explains nothing, it only wastes space. ... responded Richard, with a laugh. There was nothing to laugh about, there never is. The writer puts it in from habit automatically. He is paying no attention to his work, or he would see that there is nothing to laugh at. Often, when a remark is unusually and poignantly flat and silly, he tries to deceive the reader by enlarging the stage direction and making Richard break into frenzies of uncontrollable laughter. This makes the reader sad. ... murmured Gladys, blushing. This poor old shop-worn blush is a tiresome thing. We get so we would rather Gladys would fall out of the book and break her neck than do it again. She is always doing it, and usually irrelevantly. Whenever it is her turn to murmur, she hangs out her blush. It is the only thing she's got. In a little while we hate her, just as we do Richard. ... repeated Evelyn, bursting into tears. This kind keep a book damp all the time. They can't say a thing without crying. They cry so much about nothing that by and by when they have something to cry about they have gone dry. They sob, and fetch nothing, we are not moved. We are only glad. They gavel me, these stale and overworked stage directions, these carbon films that got burned out long ago, and cannot now carry any faintest thread of light. It would be well if they could be relieved from duty, and flung out in the literary backyard, to rot and disappear along with the discarded and forgotten steeds and allodomes and similar stage properties once so dear to our grandfathers. But I am friendly to Mr. Howells' stage directions, more friendly to them than to anyone else's, I think. They are done with a competent and discriminating art, and are faithful to the requirements of a state direction's proper and lawful office, which is to inform. Sometimes they convey a scene and its conditions so well, that I believe I could see the scene, and get the spirit and meaning of the accompanying dialogue, if someone would read merely the stage directions to me, and leave out the talk. For instance, a scene like this, from the undiscovered country. ... and she laid her arms with a beseeching gesture on her father's shoulder. ... she answered, following his gesture with a glance. ... she said, laughing nervously. ... she asked, turning swiftly upon him that strange, searching glance. ... she answered, vaguely. ... she reluctantly admitted. ... but her voice died wearily away, and she stood looking into his face with puzzled entreaty. Mr. Howells does not repeat his forms, and does not need to. He can invent fresh ones without limit. It is mainly the repetition over and over again, by the third rates, of worn and commonplace and useless forms, that makes their novels such a weariness and vexation to us, I think. We do not mind one or two deliveries of their wares, but as we turn the pages over and keep on meeting them, we presently get tired of them, and wish they would do other things for a change. ... replied Alfred, flipping the ash from his cigar. ... responded Richard, with a laugh. ... murmured Gladys, blushing. ... repeated Evelyn, bursting into tears. ... replied the Earl, flipping the ash from his cigar. ... responded the undertaker, with a laugh. ... murmured the chambermaid, blushing. ... repeated the burglar, bursting into tears. ... replied the conductor, flipping the ash from his cigar. ... responded Arkwright, with a laugh. ... murmured the chief of police, blushing. ... repeated the house cat, bursting into tears. And so on, till at last it ceases to excite. I always notice stage directions, because they fret me, and keep me trying, to get out of their way, just as the automobiles do. At first, then by and by they become monotonous and I get run over. Mr. Howells has done much work, and the spirit of it is as beautiful as the make of it. I have held him in admiration and affection, so many years, that I know by the number of those years, that he is old now, but his heart isn't, nor his pen, and years do not count. Let him have plenty of them, there is profit in them for us. English as she is taught, in the appendix to Croker's Boswell's Johnson one finds this anecdote. Cato's soliloquy. One day Mrs. Gastrell said a little girl, to repeat to him Dr. Samuel Johnson, Cato's soliloquy, which he went through very correctly. The doctor, after a pause, asked the child, what was to bring Cato to an end? She said it was a knife. No, my dear, it was not so. My Aunt Polly said it was a knife. Why, Aunt Polly's knife may do, but it was a dagger, my dear. He then asked her the meaning of an antidote, which she was unable to give. Mrs. Gastrell said, you cannot expect so young a child to know the meaning of such words. He then said, my dear, how many pence are there in sixpence? I cannot tell, sir, was the half-terrified reply. On this, addressing himself to Mrs. Gastrell, he said, now, my dear lady, can anything be more ridiculous than to teach a child Cato's soliloquy, who does not know how many pence there are in a sixpence? In a lecture before the Royal Geographical Society, Professor Ravenstein quoted the following list of frantic questions, and said that they had been asked in an examination. Mention all names of places in the world derived from Julius Caesar or Augustus Caesar. Where are the following rivers? Pisuerga, Sicaria, Guadalete, Jalón, Mulde? All you know of the following. Machacha, Pilmo, Chebilos, Krivoscha, Bassas, Manzikert, Taxim, Sito, Meloria, Zutphen. The highest peaks of the Karakoram Range. The number of universities in Prussia. Why are the tops of mountains continually covered with snow? Sick. Name the length and breadth of the streams of lava which issued from the Skaptar Jokul in the eruption of 1783. That list would oversize nearly anybody's geographical knowledge. Isn't it reasonably possible that in our schools many of the questions in all studies are several miles ahead of where the pupil is? That he is set to struggle with things that are ludicrously beyond his present reach, hopelessly beyond his present strength? This remark in passing, and by way of text, now I come to what I was going to say. I have just now fallen upon a darling literary curiosity. It is a little book, a manuscript compilation, and the compiler sent it to me with the request that I say whether I think it ought to be published or not. I said, yes, but as I slowly grow wise I briskly grow cautious. And so, now that the publication is imminent, it has seemed to me that I should feel more comfortable if I could divide up this responsibility with the public by adding them to the court. Therefore, I will print some extracts from the book in the hope that they may make converts to my judgment that the volume has merit which entitles it to publication. As to its character, everyone has sampled Glish as she is spoke and Glish as she is wrote, this little volume. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.